This talk is offered by Ordinary Minds Zen teacher Andrew Tutel. Andrew is an Australian Dharma heir of Barry Madjid and is dedicated to extending Barry's vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Find out more at ordinarymind.com.au. Andrew's Zen teachings are made possible by donations from people like you.
This Dharma, incomparably profound and minutely subtle, is rarely encountered, even in hundreds of thousands of millions of ages. Now we can see it, hear it, hold and maintain it. May we completely realize its true meaning. So we're going to be continuing the discussions on Indian Buddhism. So I'm going to share my screen again, as I did last week. Okay, let me just scroll up a bit. So we're discussing the what's called the first turning of the Dharma wheel, and we started doing that last month. And part one, we were talking about the empty self. So just to go over a couple of things. So just be aware that this session is being recorded, and the audio recording will be placed on the OzZen website. So just be aware that it's implied you give your consent to be recorded if you participate in the discussion. Every fortnight I alternate between a presentation like this, you could call it a more left brain presentation, and the following fortnight with the guided meditation is more of a right brain presentation. So today we're looking more theoretically at Buddhism. The following fortnight with the guided meditations, they're more speaking from the heart. So just two different styles of presenting that I do. So last month we started to discuss the first turning of the Dharma wheel discourse on the Four Noble Truths. And we got through went through the Four Noble Truths, we went through the Five Skandhas, and that's all on the website if you want to catch up with that. And we were up to what's called emptiness of the separate personal self, the second discourse of the Buddha, called the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta Discourse on the Non-Self Characteristics. So that's where we're up to from last month. So like with our reading group on Friday mornings, I encourage you to, if you want to come in and ask a question or make a comment, that's fine. You'll just need to unmute yourself and indicate to me that you'd like to come in. So at the end of every paragraph, I'll pause to see if there's anybody who wants to ask a question or make a comment. And if not, I'll just keep on going through the reading. All right, any questions on so far on that process? All right. The first discourse of the Buddha focused on suffering and the end of suffering, or dukkha and the end of dukkha. And it talks about the five aggregates, or skandhas in Sanskrit. The five aggregates of clinging are suffering. And then this is then elaborated on in the second discourse of the Buddha on the non-self characteristic. So we're talking about the Pali suttas. So So another name for clinging, we could say, is identification. So it is through the process of identification with the skandhas that the illusion of self arises and hence suffering arises. So remember, the skandhas are basically everything we experience, like everything from our body, our senses, our sensations, our feelings, all the particular complex thoughts and emotions which arise and perceptions through to sense consciousness. So everything that we're experiencing is, it's kind of like this bundle of aggregates that the Buddhism calls the skandhas. And through the process of identification, we take the skandhas to be ourself. The argument is that, or the Buddha wants to demonstrate, when this illusion is seen through, identification drops away and suffering is reduced or even extinguished, according to the Pali Suttas. And in Pali Buddhism, this constitutes nirvana, the ending of suffering. And nirvana is clearly seeing that all skandhas are non-self. This is the word that is translated, the Buddha uses. So in this second discourse, we witness what we might describe as the first stage of the progressive insight into emptiness. In some ways, the whole history of Buddhism can be seen as different and deepening insights into this, what this word emptiness means. So in this first insight into emptiness, the focus is on not self or non-self characteristic of the skandhas. So non-self basically means that the skandhas are empty of self. Importantly, this also implies that the emptiness of the other as well, not just the self obviously is empty, but others are also empty. Other people are empty of self. So this particular insight, if you can really get this, it makes a huge difference. And so I'm going to read a little story from Joko Beck's book, From the Everyday Zen by Joko Beck. And the little story is called The Empty Rowboat, which most of you are aware of. Suppose we are out on a lake and it's a bit foggy. Not too foggy, but a bit foggy. And we're rowing along in our little boat, having a good time. And then, all of a sudden, coming out of the fog, there's this other rowboat, and it's heading right at us, and crash. Well, for a second, we are really angry. What is that fool doing? I just painted my boat, and here he comes, crash, right into it. And then suddenly we notice that the rowboat is empty. What happens to our anger? Well, the anger collapses. I'll just have to paint my boat again. That's all there is to it. But if that rowboat that hit ours had another person in it, how would we react? You know what would happen. Now, our encounters with life and with other people, with events, are like being bumped by an empty rowboat. But we don't experience it that way. We experience it as though there are people in that other rowboat and we're really getting clobbered by them. So, you know, Joko always has a really nice way of telling these stories to make these theoretical concepts more easily understandable. So what Pali Buddhism talks about is the notion of empty persons. Okay, and we'll go more deeply into that. So, any questions or comments so far?
I love the idea of the empty other, because I'm pretty good, I think, of exploring the idea of the empty self and no self, but then I often easily forget that the other is also interconnected and empty as well. So it's a really good reminder.
Mm. Thank you. Yeah, these kinds of stories can, it's really good to have these little reminders in the course of our everyday life to remind us. So that's a really nice story to reflect on and keep in mind. Thanks, Ryan. So in this second discourse on the non-self characteristic, the Buddha defines the five skandhas as non-self because they cannot be controlled and they are impermanent. As we all know, they are subject to illness, old age, and ultimately death. Therefore, they are by definition dukkha, suffering. But this is the key, is we suffer, and this particular word dukkha, if only if we identify with them. So it's in a sense, dukkha is kind of like the suffering is about when we take the dukkhas to be, when we take the skandhas to be ourself. However, the pull to identify with our emotions and our thoughts is so strong that this process of liberating ourselves is very gradual. And it's probably unlikely that we are ever going to be able to be completely free of some residues of identification. It's more a process of gradually freeing ourselves from them and feeling a bit lighter. But it's very, very, it's not an easy process. Also, and this is often misunderstood, you know, disidentification or non-identification with our thoughts and feelings doesn't mean detachment. We still feel, according to this teaching, but we don't suffer. We still feel pain. However, the feeling, if you like, is purer. It's not complicated by the stories and judgments that arise when we identify as self and other. For example, in psychotherapy, we often talk about complicated grieving. So in a sense, when we're practicing non-self or non-identification, in a sense that we're still going to this, our personal self, that's and we're still going to experience that sense of loss. There's still going to be a feeling which arises. It's not like we become totally detached from everything, but it's not going to be complicated by how we get involved in blaming or blaming ourselves or blaming the other person, and which creates that kind of suffering that's not necessary. So even when we do identify, for example, we say to ourselves or someone else, you hurt me, that kind of process will diminish in time, in intensity and duration, because we are now more conscious and not unconscious to the process of identification. Prior to coming across the teachings, or prior to reading something or talking about this with somebody, that process of identification is just totally unconscious. It's not something we question or inquire into. But when we start to practice, we're bringing our consciousness more to that process. And the more we are able to be conscious or aware of our, so almost like an inherent tendency to identify with these emotions and thoughts, gradually we can start to bring some light into that, that helps to free us from that process of identification. In the discourse, the Buddha advises that we should observe all the skandhas in the following way. He says, any kind of form or feeling or perception or mental formation, that is emotions, thoughts, impulses, memories, or sense consciousness, should be seen as they really are with right wisdom, thus. So this is a direct quote from the second discourse. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So in other words, when we observe the skandhas with right wisdom, we see they are impermanent, interdependent, and discontinuous, and that we have no control over them. Hence, according to this teaching, they are non-self. Because the self, as defined by the Buddha, would be permanent, independent, that is, non-relational and continuous. In other words, the Buddha is saying, don't take refuge in your skandhas. Another variation of practicing non-identification is to practice thought labeling. In thought labeling, we say to ourselves, having the thought, it was your fault or my fault that that happened. So thought labeling, as taught by Joko Beck, is a good example of a non-identification practice. So I'll stop there and open that up to comments or questions. Okay, I'll just keep going then. However, even if we practice with diligence, the feeling of having a sense of self continues to linger on. It still feels as if there is an owner of our thoughts, feelings, and actions behind the thoughts, feelings, and actions. And that's totally conditioned with and promoted in our culture. However, if we continue to persist in our practice, gradually we begin to see that there is no owner of our feelings and thoughts to be found. All we can see is impermanent, moment-by-moment flux, just feelings and thoughts. And once the sense of me drops out, the complicated feelings that arise on the basis of me and mine drop away. Pain is just pain. This then creates the space for non-self-centered feelings such as compassion, care, love, and kindness to become more accessible. So in the text of this discourse on the non-self characteristics, the Buddha points to all five skandhas to show they have these three characteristics, conditioned into dependence, impermanence, and suffering. Hence, they are empty of self. When we see the skandhas are not me, we can ask who then is suffering. We can also ask who therefore is born and who therefore dies. Whenever anyone claimed any item, whether physical or mental, as self, the Buddha always critically examined the claim to argue that the item is really anatta, not self, non-self, not a self. Equivalent to saying something is not self is to say it is empty of self and what belongs to self. Any questions, comments? In the first turning of the Dharma wheel, the ultimate cause or origin of suffering is ignorance or confusion over self-identity. Desire arises because we are conditioned to identify with the five skandhas. But when we do this, we are doomed to always suffer. Whatever happiness we may experience is only temporary. However, when we see clearly that the sense of me is created by identification, we see there is no experiencer of feelings, no hearer of sounds, no thinker of thoughts, no controller of actions. We see how when we identify with the skandhas, it creates the illusion of a separate self. And if we follow the path, we see that suffering comes to an end when we cease the process of identification. If we do not identify with a thought, the thought has no power to generate suffering. A thought might arise because of past conditions, I am never good enough. But if we see clearly there is no I that the thought is referring to, then it just dissolves. It is the thought that creates the sense of I. There is no thinker of the thought. Any comments or questions? Come in, Jill. Yeah.
I understand, like, the logic of where we're going and now where we're up to, but if you just if you just think that, like, in relation to that last statement, the thought that, what was that last line you said, sorry?
It is the thought that creates the sense of I.
Yes. And there's no thinker of that thought. Well, how does the thought exist? Doesn't a thought come into being by the process of someone thinking it?
Well, that's a good question. And but from this point of view, it's kind of like a little bit like the weather. You know, there are lots of conditions and interdependencies that create the different weather patterns and conditions. The experience of our internal weather, if you like, the thoughts and emotions we experience is similar. It's a lot of it's phenomena that are interdependent. They're caused by other phenomena. You know, all of your experience of growing up, from being a child who learns a language, and that language is then internalized, and all of that process contributes to these thoughts arising.
Oh, now I'm with you. Yes, yeah, so the thinker really isn't in control of those thoughts. The thought has arisen like some aspect of the weather in relation to everything else that's going on. It's that we've got no control over it.
The situation you find yourself in will often generate or trigger some kind of thoughts. Sometimes the thoughts are just, it's hard to figure out where they come from. Sometimes they can be like dreams in a way. Where do dreams come from?
And so I guess, yeah, so thoughts are the product of our whole life to this point, experiences, but not just experiences and memories and plans into the future, but also I guess our physical state, like what our body's doing, like our digestive system because like if you've got different digestive problems, for example, that can make you really cranky and really angry and stuff.
And the next point I want to raise is probably pertinent to you, what you're talking about as well, because it's in a sense we've got to look at this from an evolutionary perspective as well. So
now I understand it a bit better. Thanks Andrew.
Did you want to come in, Tom, with a question or comment?
I was just thinking, so is this like a, you know, in statistics you can have something correlate, these variables get found together, but it doesn't say which direction the causality is. So is it making that mistake of there's two things together? You would assume that if there's thoughts, there's a thinker. So attributing, and then there's certainly this thing that creates this suffering. So then you've got something to sort of hang on to and say, well, that'll be the thinker then. But is it just sort of the other way around? Well, yeah, you've got a self of sorts, illusionary or not, there's thoughts themselves. Is it just the thoughts create?
In a sense, we can use the analogy of an illusion. Like an illusion exists, but it's not real. So in the same way we're driving along in the desert and we see what appears to be a lake in front of us. The lake has a reality, but its appearance is not real. And so the thoughts generate a sense of self or an owner of the thought in the same way. So it feels real, but it's not real.
And then can the suffering then that it creates, like that's kind of the evidence almost for a self. It's like, well, if I don't have a self, why am I suffering? What's doing that? But it might just be that the thoughts create the idea of the thinker, which then creates the suffering, which then becomes the evidence that you had a self to begin with, which then logically becomes the cause of the thoughts.
Yeah.
Is it just going the wrong way around, I guess, is what I'm asking.
If I'm understanding you, then the thought generates the feeling of a thinker and generates the suffering which arises from that. But the actual, when we can see that the thinker is just an appearance and not real, then that then helps to extinguish the suffering that we would otherwise experience.
Interesting. Thanks, Andrew.
So I wanted to pause at this point and to suggest that the creation of a sense of a separate relational self is part of our evolution as a species. So it's not like all bad, and it's important to have a healthy sense of self in order for us to get along in our culture and in our society as human beings or language speaking apes. So this identification with the scanners was an important milestone in that it created a relational self that allows us to cooperate with each other, to carry out tasks to meet our basic needs. So this illusion of a self was conducive to our survival as a species. So that's important. So it's not like we're not saying it's bad or wrong to have a sense of an ego or a separate self or a relational self, but we need to bring our consciousness towards it, because unfortunately, although it promoted our survival as a species, it also creates conflict over scarce resources, because the relational self is embedded within an attachment and tribal framework of evolution. So the relational self has the capacity for empathy and collaboration, that kind of I-thou relationship that Martin Buber talks about. But when things turn nasty, it also has the capacity to treat the other as an it, as an I-it. And so even though this notion of a self has enabled us to cooperate, and it also may contribute in the end to our destruction as a species. This is still an ongoing process of evolution that we haven't got to the end of yet. So that is why the process of non-identification is so important for our survival as a species, if we are going to survive. If we cannot transcend attachment and a tribal-based identification, we will be doomed to continuous warfare between tribes over competition for scarce resources. Unfortunately, we have the technology these days which is much more destructive than 100 or 200 or 1,000 years ago. So the Pali Buddhist sutras teach that when we stop investing in the process of identification with the skandhas, our conduct also is transformed. We are freed from being caught in the self-centered dream. Therefore, we stop accumulating karma, leading to nibbana or nirvana, the end of suffering. We are literally, in the Pali teachings, either extinguished and hence are no longer reborn, that's one interpretation, or we experience peace of mind in this life. So now I want to move on to part two of this discussion, and we'll get started on it. I call the illusory self. So before I do that, any other comments or questions on that last section? Any reflections? Okay. Buddhism teaches that to understand suffering, its rise, its cessation, and the path leading to its cessation is to see reality as it truly is. That's fairly universal across all the different schools of Buddhism, including the Theravada teachings and including the Mahayana teachings and the Tibetan teachings. And just to comment again on this notion of illusion, a quote by Rupert Spira: I do not mean to imply that the separate self is non-existent. there is a difference between something that is non-existent, like a square circle, and something that is an illusion. An illusion does exist. It has a reality, but it is not what it seems to be. So I'm going to focus, there's many different, after the Buddha died, there are many different, Buddhism broke up into different sects and different understandings. So I'm going to just keep this simple and talk about two different explanations for the illusion of self. And they're the two main, I think, explanations, but it's a simplification. So following the death of the Buddha, over time, different schools of Buddhism developed with different understandings of emptiness. In part two, I will simplify this and discuss two competing perspectives on the emptiness of self. The first perspective is known as the Abhidharma school. Abhidharma means higher teachings, if you like, which develops a theory we will call the reductionist model. And the second theory I call the two-tier illusion of self model, which I've taken from the work of Neeri Albahari, who's a philosophy lecturer in Western Australia, who specializes in Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta. So the Buddha's teachings are often referred to as the middle way. Regarding the self, it is sometimes said that he demonstrated that the sense of self we all experience was an illusion. That in fact, the sense of self arises because we mistakenly identify with the skandhas. And because the skandhas are impermanent and interdependent, there can be no such entity as a permanent, autonomous personal self. The view that there was something like an eternal soul was called eternalism in Buddha's day. However, neither did he agree with the view called annihilationism. We might call that maybe atheism today. The view that taught a person is totally destroyed at death. So the Buddha therefore taught a middle way between these two polarities. So the Buddha did not accept any of these views, but saw unenlightened beings as subject to rebirth after death, according to the nature of their previous actions or karma. The link from one life to the next was a stream of conditioned and changing states, a middle way of understanding that avoided both eternalism and annihilationism. So it's in a sense, like in that interpretation of reincarnation, it's not a permanent entity that's reborn, but it's this kind of, in the same way that we are reborn from moment to moment in this life, that particular energy continues into the next life, the desires, the impulses, and so on, just that we don't have a memory of it. Sometimes children do, according to some research. But that's an important distinction that's made in Pali Buddhism. Whether or not you agree with that, that's fine. The metaphysics of reincarnation are difficult for us to grasp in our materialistic culture. But the important thing is he tried to get a middle way between those two. And the main practical, reason for teaching not self was to free people from becoming attached to impermanent and interdependent phenomena, which they mistook for being their self, so as to free them from an unnecessary suffering. In a sense, it's a contemplative strategy, in the end, a letting go of everything. Even in these teachings, even Nibbana, the final goal of Pali Buddhism, while being seen as unconditioned and beyond impermanence and any suffering, was still understood as non-self. So the important point to remember is that when the Buddha denies the existence of a self, he is denying what was one of the accepted views of his day, that there was a personal self or soul that was totally autonomous from the body, permanent and eternal. He is not denying what we call the sense of being a self, a self that is changing from moment to moment, which we identify with, which flows on into future rebirths. It's just that it's not real. It's not permanent. Any questions on that or any comments on that? So we've got about another 10 minutes left. The problem of change and continuity is significant when it comes to talking about what we mean by self or personal identity. So another way of understanding the problem of the illusion of self is how we understand the problem of change and unity, or of discontinuity and continuity, or in other words, how we stay the same while changing. We have all experienced sometimes looking in the mirror and noticing how we have aged, yet still feel the same as when we did as a teenager. It's kind of like, yeah, my body looks different, but like I still feel the same on the inside. We have that sense of being something that's continuous throughout the whole of our life. Now this is peculiar and it's a paradox. We've all experienced this sense of continuity of identity, yet how can this be the case if we are changing from moment to moment? We all know that our cells change all the time, that and so on and so on. So how we understand this problem of change and unity is relevant to both psychotherapy and Buddhism and our understanding of self-identity. And we can approach this problem from a diachronic perspective, that is movement through time. Diachronic just means like linear time. And from a synchronic perspective, that is like viewed from now, this present moment. And so we'll explore two basic approaches to explaining the illusion of self, including how we explain the feeling of staying the same while changing. So the first model is the reductionist model. Reductionist in that it explains the illusion of a sense of being a unified self that is generated by momentary atoms of experience that are bundled together and change rapidly from moment to moment. And these basic elements are the true reality, which we are basically unaware of. They are regarded as the permanent constituents of reality, and they were called dharmas by the Abhidharma school, the teachings. The second approach, which I align with, I will call the two-tier illusion of self. This model explains the illusion of being a unified self on the basis that we all share a fundamental ground of being or consciousness, which is ultimate reality. So the Abhidharma, following the Buddha's enlightenment, he began to teach, and these teachings were recorded in the suttas. The suttas became known as the first division or basket of the Buddhist Pali canon. The second basket, the Vinaya, consists of the rules and regulations governing monastic life. And the third and final basket, the collection of Abhidharma teachings or higher teachings, are the beginnings of Buddhist philosophy. The suttas tend to be situational, intended for a particular audience on a particular day. And then there may appear to be inconsistencies or even contradictions in those suttas. Therefore, the Abhidharma texts are an attempt to systematize and expand on these teachings. So here we give the Abhidharma teachings are no longer the supposed direct words of the Buddha. They are actually texts that were written by monks 100, 200, 300 years later. Abhidharma metaphysics is based on the claim that only impartite entities, that is, things with no parts, are ultimately real. The Abhidharma school explained how we experience the illusion of self by this kind of reductionism. In this philosophy, parts were real and wholes were not real. In this model, the skandhas were reduced to unchanging, independent, self-existent elements. On this view, the skandhas were like flowing streams made up of moments, elements of reality, dharmas, at the physical and mental levels. The dharmas fall into four broad categories: consciousness, mentalities, materiality, and nirvana, each of which is analyzed in great detail. The Buddhists loved lists of all different kinds. But to keep it simple, they would analyze, for example, a chariot to show that the name of chariot only existed conventionally, but ultimately was made up of smaller and smaller parts. And there's a famous text dating from the first century about a series of conversations between a historical king called Milinda, who was of Greek origins, and a Buddhist monk by the name of Nagarjuna. I'm not quite sure if he was a real existing person or not, but the key point in this particular story is that the person or being, or indeed self, is not some mysterious essence, whether identical with any body part or with the five aggregates, but something apart from these. So basically, the story of King Milinda and Nagasena starts off with the meeting between the king and the Buddhist monk. And Nagasena, the monk, introduces himself to the king, and he basically says, "Your Majesty, please address me as Nagasena. But whether my parents gave the one name Nagasena or Sirasena or Varasena or Sahasena, it is nevertheless, Your Majesty, just a counter, an expression, a convenient designator, a mere name, this Nagasena, for there is no person here to be found." So then basically what happens in the story, which I don't have time to go into, he goes through all the different parts of his body and basically demonstrates there's no self to be found though. And he does the same with the chariot. When you pull the chariot apart, there's no actual chariot. It's kind of like there's no the king finds this very difficult to understand. But basically this is the foundational argument of the Abhidharma teachings. And this is known as mereological reductionism. The fact it reduces the whole, the chariot or the person, to its real constituent parts. And by referring to all the different parts of the body and the mind of a person, or all the different parts of a chariot, as not being the person or the chariot, Nagasena eventually demonstrate that nouns, the names we give to things, are simply convenient designations, mere conventions that serve a practical purpose. They do not exist in any substantial way. So when Milinda said he came in a chariot, what he said was true. He was referring to something real, just not a chariot. But why is this? Why not simply say that chariot is the name of a chariot? The answer is that a chariot is actually not a real thing. The parts are real, but the whole that is made up of these parts is not. The whole can be reduced to the parts. It isn't anything over and above the parts. This view came to be known as mereological reductionism. So then you see, if you add on top of that memories being linked together to form an autobiographical narrative of a person who was born on a certain date and who dies on a certain day, but for, you know, the narrative lacks substantial reality and is no more real than a dream. So you can see how where that argument goes. The illusion of self arises because we use these names like nouns to refer to chariots, to refer to each other. And we kind of like, these are just conventions, but we don't realize they're just conventions. And because we're unaware that this can be reduced to very small atomistic parts in a sense, that you're fleeting moment by moment. So that's one explanation for the illusion of self. And so next time we talk, I'll go into my preferred explanation of the illusion of self, but we don't have time to go into that today. So I'm gonna have to stop here. But if you want to look it up or Google it, the story of Milinda and the chariot is a very nice example of that particular form of Buddhist philosophy. And so before we finish, any questions or comments or anyone who's totally confused?
Yeah, hi, Andrew.
Hi, Kate.
A simple analogy would be to split an apple in two, and there's just two parts. There's nothing in the middle, there's just emptiness. And it's the same as splitting the atom. You just can split an atom, just ad infinitum. So even in quantum physics, there's the analogy that all is emptiness, that is, there's just space, there's no form, nothing solid. So yeah, I can agree with what the reading says today. I think it correlates to science, really, how we view it from today's modern quantum physics. So that's the way I understand it. I just think of an apple.
Although that's interesting, Kate. I understand what you're saying, but that's not actually what the Abhidharma school teaches. You've sort of like gone ahead. We haven't got to the emptiness teachings of Nagarjuna yet, which is more like what you're talking about. The Abhidharma school actually taught there were fundamental elements that were real, permanent, and unchanging. And they were the constituent elements that are what is real, not the actual name called the chariot or the name of the person called Melinda. But they argued in the Abhidharma teachings that there were fundamental, unchanging elements of reality. And that's something which gets challenged. We'll be talking about in a couple of months' time in the Nagarjuna's. So you've gone ahead, too far ahead.
Okay. No, that explains a little bit. Okay. Thanks, Andrew. Mm. Thank you.
Yeah. So it's important to get the Abhidharma stuff because that's what happens next in the history of the Buddhist philosophy. That notion of there being a fundamental atom-like reality is challenged later on. But it's also challenged at the same time by another theory, which I can't go into today. Yes. Any other questions or comments on this?
I'm wondering, Andrew, whether how to apply this in my day-to-day life, if it's just coming back to going, well, where is the self? You know, once I start selfing things.
Okay.
Yeah. What are your thoughts
on the? Okay, there are some questions I prepared for either for take-home practice or discussion. So the four truths, the four Buddhists, you know, the four truths are not a dogma to be believed, but practice principles to be experientially realized or understood. So here's some questions for you then. How does the philosophy of non-self guide your practice of meditation? How does the practice of meditation inform the philosophy of non-self? Meditate on the following regarding all the five skandhas. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Practice thought labeling for 5 or 10 minutes each time you meditate or even during your everyday life. And finally, this is a sort of during your everyday life, when you have an opportunity to sit and do nothing. For example, you might be in a waiting room waiting for an appointment, or you might be flying in an aeroplane. And when you sit and do nothing, what do you notice? So This text, this copy I've got, I've will be on the website, but I'll send you a copy of it anyway, so you don't have to write those down. And so we've got Tom, Phil, Jill, Kate, and Ryan. So I'll send you a copy of the text, so you got those questions if you like, Ryan.
Beautiful, thank you.
Okay. Oh, there's Elizabeth too. You weren't coming up on my thing. Okay. Well, thank you for being here this morning. I'll see some of you a bit later on. Otherwise, I'll see some of you on Tuesday morning. Have a great Sunday.
Sorry to interrupt there. I just noticed Tom's put a message, totally confused, but not your fault. I was like that when I got here. Tom, did you feel like you needed to say something?
No, that's just me being flippant. Don't worry, Ryan.
Yes. Well, confusion is the definitely what it's all about in terms of suffering. Yeah. Well, let's just finish with the practice principles. I'll just put everybody on mute again, and I'll recite the practice principles. Caught in a self-centered dream, only suffering, holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher, being just this moment, compassion's way. Caught in a self-centered dream, only suffering, holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher, being just this moment, compassion's way. Caught in a self-centered dream, only suffering, holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher, being just this moment, compassion's way.